From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 342, recorded live Thursday, October 18th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at telerik.com, and by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Paul Lutis. Paul was an electronics designer for the Space Shuttle program and author of the best-selling Apple Writer.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today on the phone, I've got Paul Lutis. He is a computer programmer and a former NASA designer. But his career has expanded much beyond NASA because he retired at about 35 and went on to do all sorts of other interesting things. Thank you, sir, for chatting with me today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So let's, if you don't mind, just for people who may not be familiar with your work, let's talk a little bit about what you did kind of in the 70s at NASA, and then we'll kind of move forward from there.
Okay. I was hired by a subcontractor of Rockwell International to design part of the space shuttle. My job was to design high-efficiency electronic inverters that take the shuttle basic power from the fuel cells, the 28-volt fuel cells, and convert it into power suitable for running lamps. And so my inverters went into all the lamps on the shuttle. When you see a news footage of the shuttle and all the lights in the crew quarters and on the flight deck, those are all my lights that run by my inverters.
Wow.
So that was my small contribution to the shuttle.
Mm-hmm. And when someone calls you and says, hey, we're going to go ahead and do this space shuttle thing, I mean, and it's the 70s, you've gone to the moon in recent memory, so it's not complete science fiction, but certainly the idea of a reusable shuttle must have felt a little bit science fiction-y.
It did. I actually, as the program went along, my involvement in the program extended over about 5 years. As the program went along, it became obvious that it was going to be a very, very complicated spacecraft, more complicated than any other had ever been. And I don't think any of us in the program had any precondition of what was going to take place during the program. But it was obviously complex. At one point, Rockwell International arrived and said, look, we have a problem with the fuel cells. We told you 28 to 32 volts was the limits to stress your inverters. We now realize that at times the voltage is going to go up to 38.5 volts. What problem, if any? And my managers, all intent on smoothing the road, were intent on saying, oh, no problem. We haven't had any problem with that. And I argued and argued. And finally, I was threatened to resign because I knew that that the Apollo disaster, which was fresh in everybody's mind in those days, resulted from people cutting corners, and I was unwilling to cut corners. So I had quite a tiff about that. And I just said, look, we can't allow this. We have specifications, and the voltage limits are the things we've agreed to. And suddenly they're asking for a rather large increase in the stress on the components, and it just isn't going to work. We have to reevaluate the design. So because I threatened to resign, and because I pushed my resignation letter into more hands than absolutely necessary, they backed down, and I was able to get the review done and make the modifications that were required to make it safe. But after the Challenger disaster in 1986, what came out of Morton Thiokol, the subcontractor responsible for the solid rocket boosters, sounded very familiar to me because they also had exactly the same thing. Some engineer who knew the system intimately well was objecting and saying, you can't launch under those conditions. And his managers overruled him and said, no, we can't say that to NASA. We got to tell them it's all right. And the next morning, the shuttle blew up. So I didn't feel so overcautious when that happened.
How does someone know, though, when you are effectively a Chicken Little? I mean, Chicken Little at the time, perhaps whistleblower after the fact, in retrospect.
Yeah.
But there must be people blowing whistles and declaring that the sky is falling all the time. You know the system more than ever.
Yes. It happens all the time.
How does the manager know that this is a problem or this isn't a problem? They ultimately either trust you or they don't.
Oh, that's your question. Yeah, well, that's a very good question. In this case, I think the managers didn't think very hard about it, and they tended to rely on their own past experiences with simpler projects And they just said, it doesn't look like a big deal to me. It's just, whatever, six extra volts. What they didn't realize was the stress on electronic components in a running electronic circuit is the square of the voltage change. And so it was a much larger difference than they were realizing. And that was beyond their expertise. So I just think they figured I would go along, even though I had objected. They thought they could talk me down. And that's one of the funny things about a position like that. I was younger than my managers. They all had more experience in the field, but none of them had worked on a complex spacecraft before. And none of them had worked with specifications that were so rigorous and specific as on the shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were inclined to just tell me that I didn't know what I was talking about. But as it turns out, I was able to put a component on a test rig and make a deliberate installation error such as might happen on the production line and blow it up by putting 38 volts on it. It exploded.
Oh,
and
wow.
At that point, I think they began to realize that I wasn't just being a nervous Nelly or whatever the expression is.
That's a fairly explicit way of making your point.
Yeah, I just said, come here, guys. And I hooked this component up deliberately backwards to make my point. And it turned out later that, in fact, a wiring person did hook one of these components up backwards, and it exploded.
Wow.
So that pretty much did the job.
When you're making specifications like this, presumably you're thinking, well, this is going to go to space, and the specifications, you know, are all assumptions. You can specify things like voltage, but then there are also environmental things that you think you're specifying, but then, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Actually, specifications for spacecraft don't allow any leeway for the person reading them. They don't say, we think this might happen or we think that might happen. They just say, the component shall survive the following temperature range and the following pressure range. And this component needs to be cooled in zero gravity, which is not so easy.
Mm.
Things like that. So it spells it out. It doesn't leave anything to the imagination. And so a person can just go, we met every specification. And actually, that's probably what NASA prefers. They don't like the, we think this will work kind of a response.
Wow. So there really is no room for error in these situations.
No, oh no, no, it's very specific. A NASA specification for a spacecraft, a manned spacecraft, is more explicit and specific than any legal document you can imagine reading. It just says exactly the temperature, humidity, vibration, everything else, voltage range, all those things are spelled out explicitly, which is why, by the way, Rockwell International came forward. As soon as they realized that because of a bus switching procedure error, the voltage on the bus might go up to 38.5 volts, they instantly told everybody. Within 24 hours, once they realized it, they got to that stage in the design and they said, whoops, what happens if this switch is turned this way and that switch is turned that way? The fuel cell is completely unloaded and they hadn't considered that possibility. And the voltage leapt up to 38.5 volts and they instantly informed everybody by memo within 24 hours, which NASA required them to do, of course.
Wow. I've looked at some of the documents that you can get. You can go up to NASA.gov and there's a technical reports server. And I've spent some time looking over some of your documents from 1977 through 1981. They're all available as PDFs, or you can order them. And the language is extremely dense. There is no room at all for error in the language. It's almost like a legal document. I mean, I've worked on banking systems, but I've never seen anything quite this. Dense is the only word that I have for it as far as information dense.
Yeah. When I reported on my work in articles, technical articles, I was already predisposed to writing it in a way that there'd be no possibility for ambiguity. But then it went through several review cycles with people both in NASA and in my own company to make sure there wasn't anything left to chance. And so what you see there in those documents is the result of several editorial passes after my own writing. And I tend to be the kind of person who writes in an explicit way without ambiguity. But that natural tendency was amplified by the people who reviewed it afterward.
Wow. And then afterwards, I am told that you created a mathematical model of the solar system that ended up being used on the Mars mission.
Yes. I in the early 70s, the first programmable calculators arrived. And this was well before personal computers were available. But I was really curious about programming and solving mathematical problems. So as soon as one was available, I bought one. It was an HP 65, I believe, was the first one, or the HP 25, one of the two. And I had great fun with it. And pretty quickly, I had written a solar system model using pretty simple methods. for all nine planets. And I published it in a magazine. And the people at JPL, all of whom had the same programmable calculator, wanted it so they could use it in their daily work, because they otherwise had to submit a batch job to a huge mainframe to get a prediction about a trivial positions of the planets kind of problem. So I got in touch with them, and they asked for some changes, and they pointed out an error I had made in the position of Pluto. So I got an amount of correspondence. So that's the basis of that, is the people at JPL were using my program on there, on the same programmable calculator I was using to create the program.
What made you kind of, and dropout is not meant in any way of a pejorative term, but what made you stop kind of working so intensely and then instead kind of moving to a more remote location and kind of focusing
on... This is going to sound a bit hokey, but I was deprived of a childhood. And so once I had enough money to retire, I did so just to be able to go do something besides work for a living. I had never actually done the sort of thing that children do when they're children. Mm-hmm. That part of my life was never existed. It never happened. So I had a much narrower and more conservative idea of having enough money for retirement. In the early 70s, I got enough money together to buy a small, silly piece of land in Oregon and still have $3,000 left over. So I said, "Up, time to retire." So I had gotten done with my work for NASA. The project was completed. And the people I worked with obviously wanted me to stay on and work on a lot more things because I was pretty good at what I did. But I explained what I just said, and I guess they reluctantly agreed. But they kept me on as a consultant for a couple of years afterwards. So every couple of months, I would go down for a week and solve some engineering problems for them and then go back. And I had a vegetable garden, and I had a little wood-heated cabin and things like that. It was great fun. And so I did my back-to-the-woods phase in the middle of the 70s when apparently everyone else was doing it. And then the fun part, I was sitting in my little cabin, my 12-by-16-foot cabin, reading a copy of Scientific American with a kerosene lantern. And there was an advertisement for the Apple II. It was 1977. There was an advertisement for the Apple II. And I said, "Oh my God, this is better than even a programmable calculator." So I ordered one with 2/3 of the money I had left. I ordered an Apple II, thinking how much fun it would be to play with. I wasn't thinking about anything else beyond that. Just to have a computer of my own was just mind-boggling to me at the time. And then about a year later, 2 years later, a magazine asked me to write an article about Einstein's theory of relativity for the centennial, 1979, of Einstein's birth. So I started writing the article, and it was a bit more complicated than the articles I'd written for them in the past. There's a bunch of different bits and pieces to special relativity. It's not so easy to write about for a popular audience. And so pretty soon I had pieces of paper all over the room with little bits and chunks of ideas that I wanted to get into the article, but in exactly the right order. The thing about special relativity is you can't skip over anything, and you don't want to put something complicated in too early if it isn't tied in with what's around it. So it's a perfect place for some kind of a textual organizer. So then I thought, okay, I have an Apple II, and I've been programming various silly programs with it. Maybe I'll write a program to organize all these bits and pieces of notes, and I can move them around on the screen and just add things and remove things. So in parallel, I started writing a word processing program and the article for the magazine. So I was the customer of my program, and I was using the program half the time and writing the program half the time. And I called it LexiCalc, which is a program name that hasn't been used yet, probably because I told people they couldn't use it. But anyway, I called it LexiCalc, and I envisioned that it would be popular like VisiCalc, and it would be for words what VisiCalc was for numbers. Anyway, Apple heard about it, and by then they realized that they couldn't sell any more Apple IIs unless they had some programs readily available for people who weren't themselves programmers. In other words, end users of personal computers. So they were more than excited about having more applications available. So they heard about my program, and they asked to see it. So I rode my bike down to the mailbox with a big manila envelope, thinking to myself, "Hey, maybe they'll like my program. Maybe I'll make $100. And in the next 5 years, it became a bestseller. It was available worldwide, and it was called Apple Writer. And that's why I retired. And one of the reasons I retired is I really made a lot of money on that program, and I retired again. I guess one could say that I retired from my retirement.
Hey, this is Scott, and I'm really excited about these guys. This is a special offer from our friends at DN Simple. True story, Carl reached out to DN Simple to ask them if they wanted to advertise with Hansel Minutes because we like them that much. It was a kind of a funny thing. They didn't come to us. We went to them because we think DN Simple is great. It's a hosted DNS service that you use to manage your domain names. Prices start at about $3 a month for up to 10 managed domains. You can also use DN Simple to register domain names, purchase SSL certificates. All of my domains have been moved off of GoDaddy and are now at DN Simple. I like it because there's an application on my iPhone. I can manage my DNS from there. There's an API that you can use. The best part, actually, is these one-click services. So you can register a domain, get it up and running in a couple of minutes, and then go in and apply services to it. So you can say, this domain is for Google Apps, and this domain is for GitHub Pages, and this domain is for Posterous. And they know the DNS records and set them up for you. Even for something as complicated as Google Apps, there's like 11 different settings you need to create. They handle it all for you. So here's the deal. They've got a special 30-day trial. You can cancel at any time. But Hansel Minutes listeners get 3 months of free DNS service. So you go to dnsimple.com/HM. Special deal for Hansel Minutes listeners. Just visit dnsimple.com/HM. Hansel Minutes listeners get 3 months of free DNS service. Love these guys. They're so nice. DN Simple, hosted DNS. Check them out.
Were you clever enough or prescient enough to keep them from giving you $100 and then running off with the money?
Actually, things worked my way. I think nature favored me in spite of my silliness. The original version of AppleWriter I sold to Apple outright for $7,500. But the problem was they had no programmers at Apple to improve it, and people wanted improvements right away. They wanted a wider display, more characters, upper and lower case, all kinds of things like that. And especially as the Apple II hardware evolved and made it possible to display upper and lowercase characters and 80 columns wide, all those sorts of things. And so finally, after a while, they just gave up and they said, do you have a new version of your program? I said, yeah, but one, it's a completely different version. It has nothing to do with the previous one, which was true. And two, I'm not selling it to you. We'll do a royalty arrangement. And by then they had anticipated that that would be the case because of how badly the first one went. They took my program, the one I sold to them for $7,500, and stripped out my name and copyright notice and sold it as an Apple product. And I asked them how they thought they could do that. And they said, well, you didn't tell us we couldn't. So anyway, I got a chance to have a preview of what could go wrong, where the stakes weren't very high in the late 70s before the main stream event took place. So I was able to benefit from my past mistakes in a way that no great loss was incurred. So the new program, which I had totally rewritten and it made it much more efficient. And I insisted on a number of things. One, it was royalties only. I wasn't selling them the program. And two, they couldn't take out my name. So the only reason I'm a household or was a household name in the personal computer world in the mid-80s, for example, was because of that, that I told them they couldn't take my name out of the program. So they said, okay, royalties, that's fine with us. That means no upfront money. What royalty rate? And I said, oh, I don't know, 25%. How's that sound to you guys? And they said, sure, no problem. 25% sounds reasonable. Neither of us realized that royalty rates on software are almost never that high. And the result was that they sold quite a lot of copies of the program, but the volume of software in those days was a tiny fraction of what it is, for example, with Microsoft now. But notwithstanding that, it was quite a lucrative arrangement. And then as the sales started going up in a hockey stick fashion, they said, this 25% thing, that wasn't such a great idea. And I said, well, yeah, maybe not, but I don't think that we should change it at this point. So they argued about it a little bit, but I was unwilling to give way. There was no incentive for me to change it, and I think they finally realized that the program was selling itself. They didn't need to try very hard to get people to buy it.
And how long did that last?
From around 1980 or 81 until about 85. And it was in the millions. I'll just say it was in the millions of dials and royalties.
But when these things go up in a hockey stick fashion, I know I wrote an application for the original Palm Pilot, and it went up in a hockey stick fashion, and we made all sorts of money, and then it just disappeared.
Huh.
It just disappeared. Well, it just dropped off.
What was happening in the early to mid 80s was that people were buying more Apple IIs because there was a program, or there was VisiCalc and AppleWriter were the two best-selling programs at the time. And people, it dawned on people that A, there was software available, so they weren't buying a hobbyist machine anymore. Mm-hmm. And B, a personal computer made sense, which in those days, you know, people were becoming aware of the fact that there was a new consumer product called a personal computer. And that was fact number one. And fact number two was how many of them were there. This was when, IBM was selling their personal computer as an entry system for their mainline business. The IBM people in those days never really appreciated that there was a market for personal computers. They thought of it as a way to get people to buy larger machines, just as a sort of an introductory thing. And they actually called it the entry system. That was their name for it, internal to IBM. Oh, I have a story about IBM. At the height of AppleWriter's popularity, IBM called me up and they say, we'd like something like AppleWriter for the IBM PC. I said, okay, what business terms? And there was a long pause. They were accustomed to talking to programmers who weren't their own managers. And so I think they were shocked by the fact that I instantly switched over to the business mode. Anyway, they said, well, we have this worked out. We'll give you $100,000 in royalties, after which we own the program. And I said, $100,000 in royalties? Let's see. That's 10 days of royalties on AppleWriter right now, which was true. And there was a long pause on the phone line. I think they realized at that point they weren't going to get anywhere. They then called John Draper, a.k.a. Captain Crunch, and offered him the same deal, and he took it. And it wasn't a very good program. I forget the name of it, but it wasn't very good. And when somebody asked him about it later, allegedly, John Draper replied, they asked for a $100,000 program. I gave them one. Now, I can't verify that quote, but I've heard it from several different sources. So,
how did you turn it into freeware then after 1992, after, you know, it was discontinued?
As soon as the program became popular and successful, it occurred to me that it was going to be too pricey. It was $125, which in those days was a lot of money for a program. I decided to create a version that was missing a few features that I could give away in schools. And so I did that. I would call it FreeWriter. And Apple agreed. I showed them the program, and it wasn't able to print. It was just it was able to create data files, and, you know, it was limited so that they wouldn't be upset. And I was able to offer it. And for a while, there was a program called FreeWriter floating around, and everybody knew it was mine. And then somebody took it over and added a print feature to it and called it FredWriter and charged people $10 for it. So that was my first exposure to what happens when you offer free software, is somebody will take it over and offer it for sale. And since then, I have to tell you that because I have so many free programs on my website, that I'm constantly having to try to keep people from selling my free programs or packaging them together on a DVD and offering them for sale and things like that. It's just exceedingly annoying. And one reason is people who are young enough and inexperienced enough don't realize that if something is free, it doesn't mean that's all right for you to sell it. That doesn't necessarily follow. And I think a person who's young enough, who doesn't know enough about law, might think that because something is free, then it's all right to sell it. And I've had any number of conversations with young programmers who didn't understand that doesn't follow.
When you were a young programmer and you were getting started in the business, and not necessarily a young programmer in the age sense, but in the, you know, you're getting into personal computing, you've created AppleWriter, you're having some success. Are you hanging out virtually or otherwise with, you know, the Dan Bridkins or the, you know, Charles Simonyi? Are you, is this a club of people?
Because my entire programming career took place from rural Oregon and elsewhere out in the woods, I hardly ever met people like that. And I would get an invitation to go to the Hackers Conference every year, and I would just forget it. I wouldn't do it. So I never actually met any of those people. I met a lot of people at Apple, of course, directly, people who worked for Apple and people who showed up. Mm-hmm. But I didn't actually meet most of the people who were in the mainstream. I would exchange letters from time to time and then maybe a TV interview, that sort of thing. But I didn't have that as a peer group, not really. And not because people didn't ask me to, but I just wasn't interested. I didn't want to abandon. I regarded that I had the perfect world. I was living in the woods, and it was quiet and pretty, and I could write programs. And it just, you know, I didn't want to go to the city. When I did go to the city, I have to mention this in passing, I was unwilling to make any compromises. And the distance between where Apple was located in Cupertino and the San Jose Municipal Airport was maybe, well, I don't remember, maybe 10 miles, 12 miles. And so what I would do is I'd ride my bike to the airport where I had my airplane. This was when I had royalty money, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd put my bicycle in the airplane and fly down to San Jose, land the airplane, take the bicycle out of the airplane, and ride my bike to Cupertino. And people who saw me showing up, they didn't quite, you know, we thought you lived in Oregon. Well, yeah, I do. And I just rode my bike down.
You rode your bike all the way down just to have a little mini flight in the middle part there.
I didn't necessarily mislead them to that extent, but I think it took them a while to realize that I was mixing bicycles and airplanes.
What do you feel about building software as a single individual where, you know, you've built Apple Rider and you've built Arachnophilia and you've built stuff where you understand it from the beginning to the end versus working on something larger than any one human could possibly understand, like a subsystem within this picture?
I'm not sure my opinion on that subject is worth very much since I've never done the latter that you just described.
But you built a subsystem as part of a larger system that then, you know, became part of a space shuttle.
Yeah, but that was electronics.
Is there that much of a difference? Is not creation of a system a creation of a system?
It's very different. If you write a piece of software as a team with other software developers, you have to be very careful about naming conventions and interfacing and all that sort of thing. If you write a piece of if you create a piece of a spacecraft, all you need to be aware of is where it mounts physically and what the voltage is that it's going to be driven by. So it's much, much simpler. Now, that's obviously not true for all spacecraft work. If I had been responsible for part of the avionics or something like that, that would have been different.
I see.
But the irony was that my inverters appeared all over the space shuttle, 20 or 30 of them altogether, in the cargo bay, in the crew quarters, on the flight deck. But they were all pretty much alike, and they were individually quite simple because all they had to do was be hooked up to 28 volts, and they provided light. So it was much simpler, you know. And by the way, once I realized how simple the outcome was, the desired function was, I made the design as simple as humanly possible. I had a very simple design, which I did deliberately. A lot of people in the field of electronics would like to have a design complex enough that it ends up being an advertisement for their ingenuity. I didn't feel that way about it at all. All I wanted to do was not catch fire and kill astronauts. That's all I cared about. So I deliberately chose the simplest possible design. And when people read the documents we were referring to earlier online, they can see that it's extremely simple. I did all I could to eliminate parts and limit the parts count. Mm-hmm. So that there'd be fewer modes of failure. So I think actually a large software project with multiple programmers is way more complicated. And in fact, it's quantitatively so different that it ends up being qualitatively different. So even in hardware design, I've never had a big teamwork component where I had to name things in certain ways and learn how to communicate in certain ways. And certainly in the world of software, I'm really an atavism, a throwback. I've never worked on a software project with even one other person in my entire career.
Wow. Have you taken your love of simplicity or your striving for simplicity and applied it to the software that you did and do continue to create?
Oh, yes. And I also release most of my source code. On most of my projects, my source code is released so people can look for themselves and see that I name things in certain ways to make it easy to sort things out. So yes, I try to avoid complexity there also. And as I get older, the reason becomes more obvious. I don't want to not be able to understand my own projects after 5 years.
Yeah, coming upon software after the fact.
That's a big danger as you get older. And even at the peak of one's career, if one writes a complex piece of software with the intent of blowing the minds of people around them, the risk is that after 90 days, they won't understand their own code. I try to avoid that one.
So you release things for free and you put them out there, but you do still maintain copyright. You've put out software. You've put out your book.
I'm sure you know the reason why. If I release a program and don't have a copyright on it, people will take it and incorporate it into their own projects and offer it for sale. In fact, I have to tell you that a number of occasions where I have released under the GPL, mm-hmm. people have taken the code and just stripped out the GPL notice and used it in their project.
Oh, wow.
Because of that mentality. I actually don't think most of the people who do that have criminal intent. They're just too young and inexperienced to understand mm-hmm. that the fact that something is free doesn't mean that they can sell it, they take it over and sell it. It doesn't mean that.
What makes you want to put things out for free? I mean, you put out a book when you did your Around the World solo sale.
Now we're switching over to the truly philosophical.
Yeah.
Well, since I retired at the age of 35, I always wanted to retire as young as possible and go play because I never got to play when I was a kid. And I always thought that was a lack in my background. But what didn't occur to me, that if I succeeded in retiring, that I'd face a problem that I certainly hadn't anticipated, which was that I needed to feel as though I was accomplishing something, that I had constructive work. So I'm really a workaholic, and I could never actually be retired in the sense of going fishing. Though I always have to have some sort of project, a sense that I'm useful to other people. And I just said this to my neighbor the other day about something unrelated. I really have to feel useful to other people. That's a core value of mine. And so if I write a program, I'm always thinking, oh, well, let's see, is this going to be something that people will find useful? And I just did an SQL tutorial with that in mind, just to make sure that I hardly ever write programs for my own use. And if I do write a program that's really only for me, I don't necessarily even release it. But if I do release a program, it's with the knowledge that somebody will find it useful.
So producing is something that drives you. I mean, you don't necessarily want to get paid. Like I said, you put out your book and it remains free, but you produced and you put it out there and hopefully it helps someone.
Yeah. People find it useful. People find that what I do useful. Obviously, if you work for a living, if you worked for a living and made a salary, but you knew that what you did was completely useless to anyone else, it would probably destroy it for you. It would certainly destroy it for me. I don't know about other people. So if you do something for free, I think the same rules apply. If you do something gratis, if you intend to put it out there and offer it for free, you still want it to be useful to people. Otherwise, you wouldn't necessarily do it.
Let me ask you this in closing. What is the thing that you are the most proud of? What accomplishment are you the most proud of, free or otherwise?
Oh, okay. Here's my answer. When I lived in Oregon and I was getting royalties for AppleWriter, I became aware of the fact that I'm not going to say which town in Oregon. There was a 15% pregnancy rate at the local high school. And so I single-handedly started a Planned Parenthood clinic in that town against fierce local opposition with my own funds. And there were death threats, and there were firebombings of doctor's offices and all kinds of things. It was the single thing in my entire career that I was most proud of because it actually made a difference. Young women were able to complete their educations. Certain number of lives weren't destroyed. And naturally enough, because I'm a lifelong rebel, the fact that everybody was angry about it and couldn't understand why I was doing it, that helped also.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate you sharing your stories with us. And people can go up on your website at arachnoid.com. They can download your book, Confessions of a Long-Distance Sailor. They can even purchase that on Amazon or on Lulu. And they can also check out your applications, both past and present, up on your website. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, sir.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.